I'm not leaving my room until I see UNHCR. I want asylum.
18-year-old Rahaf Mohammed Al-Kunun fled her home country of Saudi Arabia last weekend. Al-Kunun is seeking refuge from her family, who she says threatened to torture and kill her for leaving the Muslim faith. Now she's under the protection of the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. After leaving Saudi Arabia on a flight to Thailand, Al-Kunun's story went viral on social media as she began tweeting her standoff with Thai immigration officials from inside an airport hotel room. But Al-Kunun is not alone. The Saudi government estimates 577 women attempted to flee their homes in 2015. But that number is likely much higher. Sarah Aziza is a journalist covering human rights and women's issues in the Middle East, and her most recent reporting is with the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting. Sarah, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
So let's talk a little bit about Rahaf, who we heard at the top of the segment. Tell us more about the specifics in her deciding to flee from her family.
Sure. So according to Rahaf's own testimony, she was facing domestic abuse physically, psychologically at home. And then she also cited just the general oppressive atmosphere inside Saudi Arabia. She actually renounced Islam, which is not what every female asylum seeker chooses to do. But she also, said that she saw the religion as an oppressive force in her life. And that is a very dangerous statement to make as well. So she said that she wanted an education, a career, and a future, and felt like that was impossible in Saudi Arabia.
You know, you've been doing a lot of reporting on people who are fleeing Saudi Arabia in particular. Your latest work is focusing on women. Tell us about what we're seeing more broadly. What are the dangers that women are facing in the country?
Again, domestic violence is a very big issue there. It's vastly underreported. I interviewed many women who were facing domestic abuse at the hands of their fathers, uncles, even brothers. Actually, Rahaf was fearful of her brother as well as her father taking revenge on her if she should be deported back to Saudi Arabia. So brothers can also play a big role. And then one of the reasons that violence in the home is so prevalent is because women have very little recourse. The laws have only recently come to criminalize domestic abuse at all. And practically speaking, it's very unlikely that women are going to get help. I've spoken to many women in Saudi Arabia and then asylum seekers abroad who report trying to seek help. Women are often blamed or just face worse abuse after being rebuffed by the authorities. So it's really a pretty dire situation. And this is all sort of bolstered and supported by the Saudi guardianship system, which we've been hearing a lot about with Rahaf's case, which renders women legal minors in Saudi Arabia. So women are subject throughout their lives until the day they die. They are under the authority of their male guardian, which could be a father, uncle, husband, even a son. So we can see a woman in their 60s maybe who might be unmarried or widowed and be subject to the will of her teenage son, for example, for many legal and social services.
So with that as the backdrop, what's interesting, I think, is that the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, Mohammed bin Salman, has been in some ways painted as this progressive reformer of the country, particularly when it comes to women, right? Mm-hmm. We've heard that Saudi women can now drive, which was a huge deal. And you mentioned this law that, you know, is supposed to protect or give women recourse for, you know, who are facing domestic violence. What's the reality here? Is this a lot of, not necessarily political theater, but is it a lot of sort of, you know, big shiny objects and taking away from the reality for women in Saudi Arabia?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's undoubtable that some women do enjoy more freedom and more opportunity than they have in the past. Some women have really supportive, loving families, and they're able to get that education, get that job, now get behind the wheel of a car. But it really speaks to sort of the place we began when being allowed to drive a car is, you know, this huge milestone for women. Mohammed bin Salman, or MBS, as many of us call him in the media now, granted the right to drive at the same time as locking up women who dared to speak publicly about the need for greater equality, the need to dismantle the guardianship system, as I mentioned. And practically speaking, many women don't see much of a difference at all in their day-to-day lives because really a lot of the decisions are made within the home by the husband, the father, and, you know, influential male relatives. And even when the laws are beginning to shift a little bit as far as what women could theoretically be able to accomplish, practically speaking, judges, police, authority figures tend to still defer to whatever male authority figure might be present in the woman's life. And so it really comes down to not who's the crown prince, but who's your father or husband. And there are still many people who adhere to really regressive ideas of what a woman's role should be.
And given that backdrop as well, you said women can't get passports. How do women flee Saudi Arabia? I mean, mm-hmm. the logistics of that and what mm-hmm. you're describing is very structural. Mm-hmm. How are women able to get out? What are the actual logistics of doing that?
It's really quite a daring and risky thing to try and escape Saudi Arabia. I actually have a piece coming out in The New Yorker this week that describes the journey of several women who fled Saudi Arabia to Europe, and in their stories, sort of, we describe the logistics of how they pulled that off. So women will need to either get a passport through the wali or guardian, whether it's in Rahaf's case, when the family travels together abroad, the father will, you know, sort of see that as, okay, a reason to grant his daughter a passport. Other women are stealing their father's phones and using an app. The Ministry of Interior in Saudi Arabia has a popular app called Abshar that most men have on their phones. So women describe stealing their father's phones, hacking into them. They're able from there to log on to the Ministry of Interior and impersonate their fathers and issue themselves the paperwork to get travel permission or passports.
What happens to many of these women after they flee?
Well, for those who do make it out, and many are stopped at the airport, many are apprehended or intercepted in Rahaf's case. There was another woman just last year who was intercepted in the Philippines, Dina Ali Laslum. So many women don't make it. But those who do, it depends on where they land and the asylum laws of that country. So Australia is a popular destination. That's where Rahaf was going. A few other places in Western Europe. So if they're able to, you know, sort of begin asylum proceedings there. It varies from country to country, but what's pretty universal and pretty tragic is many of them have to look forward to a life without any family connections, without ever going back to their home country. I spoke to many women who really broke down talking about how much they miss their mothers or little brothers, how much it hurts that their friends are afraid to talk to them. A lot of family and friends do face government interrogation in suspicion that they might have helped these women escape. So it's really quite a drastic and brave thing for any of these women to attempt. They're incredibly courageous, and it really speaks to what they're facing back home, that they're willing to pay such a price.
Sarah Aziza is a journalist covering human rights and women's issues in the Middle East, and she has a piece on Saudi women coming out in The New Yorker this week. Sarah, thanks again.
Thank you.